celebrities. Yeah. So thank you very much. Without further ado, and I'm really delighted to have Katie here, because I think those of you who came in February, I think were blown away actually by the brilliant things she was telling us about the work that Indigo have been doing since the pandemic, which, you know, I think she deserves a knighthood for. It's amazing. So, Professor Jane Allenwright, I'm delighted again we'll be welcoming Katie to the stage. Thank you.
Thanks, Fiona. And I think that's a good segue, talking about research, to introducing Katie. So Katie is the founder and CEO of Indigo, which is one of the UK's leading consultancies on data-driven marketing on cultural organisations. So during COVID, Katie developed and delivered the largest free survey programme of cultural attendees' attitudes to returning to events. Beginning with after the interval, working with around 600 organisations and capturing respondents from over 300,000 attendees. So we last heard from Katie in February at our online conference, where she also presented research on audiences and digital culture. But today she's going to be talking about audiences reconnecting and returning to live events. So I'd like to welcome Katie today.
Thank you. And thank you so much, Fiona, for inviting me to be with you today. This is the first in-person conference that I've done since COVID, and it's just so much nicer being able to see you all than just talking into my computer, which I've got just so used to, as we all have. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain some of the research we've been doing. Probably most of you heard my talk in February, so I'm not going to go through all of that again. I'm going to give you an update on what's happened since and talk a little bit about missing audiences, so audiences that haven't been back yet and perhaps why that is. And I'm going to talk a little bit about, well, two things really. One, the strategic implications, longer term implications of all of this, which hopefully will feed into your conversations for the rest of the day, but also some quite practical things that you can be doing now as you're planning for festivals coming up next year. And ultimately what this is about is reconnecting with audiences and connecting with new audiences, and I think we need to think about both. So Indigo is my company. We set up 15 years ago, and what we do is hopefully powerful insight and sensible consultancy for a stronger cultural sector. So I've always worked in this sector. I was previously marketing director of many different organisations, so I've done it hands-on, and I've been consulting for the last 17 years and set up Indigo 15 years ago. So what I'm going to give you today is the latest insight on COVID and cultural audiences. And then we can start to look a little bit beyond that, hopefully. So, as you know, we did, after the interval, was our what I thought was going to be a quick survey for the sector to just give us a bit of a snapshot. And it was a quick survey, but then, of course, people were already going, what are you doing next? I was like, oh, shit, do I have to keep doing this? So then we did, after the interval, Act 2, because we realised in the first survey that there were sort of things emerging like outdoor arts and digital arts that we hadn't really asked much about. So we asked a lot about that in Act 2. And as you can see, we had lots of organisations participating and lots of responses, which was great. And then from October, we teamed up with our partners Baker Richards and One Further, who were previously competing consultancies. Mm-hmm. And we reached out to them and said, do you know what? Would you like to come and help us, because we're getting a bit swamped with all this? And at the time, I was one person organisation, because my business partner had left to go and run Spitalfields Festival in London. And so I was on my own doing all of this. So actually teaming up with some previous competitors has been one of the best things that I've done, and it's taught me a bit of a life lesson, really. So I teamed up with them and recruited two staff myself, which was brilliant. And we started doing the Culture Restart Toolkit, which involved three things. One was an audience tracker, which was basically similar to the previous surveys. You sent it out to your mailing list or people and asked them lots of the same questions so we could see how things were changing. The second was a digital experience survey, where we asked them to send it to people who had engaged digitally, if they knew who they were. And the third one was a post-experience survey for people who were starting to reattend in person, so that we tried to get a full picture of the people who were attending, the people who were consuming digitally, and just the general snapshot of their audiences. So we've been doing that since October. And then more recently, we've done the missing audiences survey to find out about people who haven't been back at all, which I'll talk about in a minute. And these are the sort of organisations who've been engaging. Obviously, we've had hundreds of organisations. I know some people in the room have got involved. So a good few festivals in there, mostly venue-based, mostly performing arts-based, although we have had some museums and galleries involved. It's mostly been performing arts, live events sector that we've been talking to. We've also done other research programmes with some of these organisations. We did a specific project with Outdoor Arts, with the Family Arts Campaign, Point One, who were a point of sale commercial company, who were interested in to what extent the food and beverage part of reattending was important. And that was fascinating, actually. We've done a similar study with UK Sport about people returning to live sports events, with cinemas, with Live UK, which you probably know is the new industry body for live music sector. And also we've done some work with Marquee TV, who are like the Netflix of cultural content. So the reason for telling you this isn't to boast, it's basically to say I think we've got a pretty good picture now of what's going on across the industry, and tons of data. So hopefully we can speak with some authority about what we think is going on. So I'm going to give you some quick headlines from the research, and this is very much an overview of the last 12 months. So if you want to know any more detail about anything, all the reports, all the data is available on the Indigo website. So if there's something particularly that you want to look at, then email me and I can point you towards it, or go and have a delve around. And I'm going to talk to you about missing audiences because we only released the results of that last week. So these graphs are very, very top level, and what we've tried to do is show through our research programmes how sentiment or things have changed over the last 12 months. This takes us up to July 21, and then the missing audiences survey will fill in some of the blanks. But what you can see here is the black bit at the bottom is the proportion of people who have actually booked for something in the future. So you can see that that has risen from just under 20% back in May 2020 to 60% by July 21. Now, if that were to continue on that trajectory, which is a big if, which we'll come back to in a minute, but if it was, it would take until the end of March next year to get back to normal. I don't think that's going to happen for reasons I'll explain in a minute. But it's not going to be before then. So, you know... And around 20% are now saying, well, we're saying at that point that they will book in the next 6 months. This 6 months thing has been really interesting because it's been the sort of, it's far enough away for people to go, yeah, I'll do that in about 6 months. But it just rolls on. It just rolls on. And you know, even though the proportion is going up, there's still a significant proportion of people who are always going to book in 6 months. And 20% still remain unsure, and we'll come back to that lot in a minute. Then we asked them about how safe they think cultural venues are to visit. And actually, the majority of people, 80% now, at August 21, saying that they think cultural venues are safe to visit. So it's not that they're staying away because they think they're not going to be looked after well by the cultural organisations. And again, I've got some more data on that in a minute. How did you feel about your recent visit? Now, this is interesting because it asked them how they felt before they attended and then after they attended. And you can see the green bars, the 28% and the 35% on the top one, they're fairly happy or they were feeling brilliant. Okay, but after attending the event, that jumps right up to 82% of people feeling brilliant. So the act of attending is actually building confidence. We know that if we can just get them over the line to actually make an attendance, partly because they feel safe in the venues, they can see the amount of effort that's gone into keeping them safe, they're really happy about what's happened. The big problem is the people that we can't get over the threshold. These were some of the comments that they made after the visit. So, you know, lovely, lovely comments, which is nice. But if we then look at the people's hesitancy, there's still significant hesitancy to return. And if we said, okay, so imagine if the venue just went back to operating as it did before COVID, how would you feel about that? And the big red blob is the people saying they're uncomfortable about it. And really interesting, you can see it dips as we go into the third lockdown there at the bottom. You can see that people were somehow, partly because of the, we won't even go there, but the government messaging and all that kind of stuff, for some reason people thought, oh, maybe cultural venues aren't safe. So they felt a lot more uncomfortable. And, you know, the majority of attenders continue to feel comfortable or say it would make them less likely to attend. We slightly changed the question between July and August from less likely to more likely, but still you can see that the significant red bar there is people saying, I wouldn't be happy with all venues, all measures being dropped. Just a point on this, the key things here, the things people are trying to avoid, people are very uncomfortable, and regardless of whether they're in England, Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland, the thing that would make the biggest difference to them is mask wearing. Mm-hmm. Most of them say they would feel very uncomfortable, or it would make them a lot less likely to attend if they couldn't be reassured that everybody would be wearing a mask. And we've seen in person different experiences, and we had interesting conversations on our webinar last week about missing audiences, with venues as kind of presenting the data to them, and venues saying to us, yeah, but you can't make front of house people enforce mask wearing. And we said, well, we've experienced firsthand two theatres in the same town, one of which messaged right up, all the messaging you got in advance said, we will be expecting you to wear a mask. It was printed on the tickets, it was done on the confirmation email, it was everything, signs on the doors when they arrived. Members of staff walking up the aisles of the theatre with signs saying, please put your masks on. And people were putting them on. And about 90% of people were wearing masks in that theatre. Another theatre, sort of bit fey messaging, sort of do it if you like, don't if you don't. 10% of people wearing masks. So, you know, there are things that can be done. And I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong to be pro or against mask wearing. What I'm saying is the data suggests that audiences would be much more likely to return if they could guarantee that other people would be wearing masks. Social distancing, to some extent, they're very worried about other people's behaviour is the other one. That's the biggest one of all. They think the venues are running things fine. They think that you're trying to keep them safe. It's all great. Other people is their biggest worry. So what we've done is we went back through all our research because we were like, okay, so there's clearly a big swathe of people who are still feeling uncomfortable about returning. What can we do to reassure those people? So we went back through all the research that we've gathered with a fine-tooth comb and kind of pulled out these five key themes, which I don't think we developed when I spoke to you in February. And what we've kind of come across is there are five main things that you need to reassure, ways in which you need to reassure visitors. One is obviously health and safety, which is the most obvious one. This is what they're saying they need. Will I be safe? You know, they want to see safety measures remain in place. As I said, 63% more likely to attend if capacity is limited. 62% more likely to attend if there's some form of vaccine, passport or COVID certification. And 55% more likely to attend. That's actually gone up since we looked at this. And this is the big problem about, are the rules going to be enforced? Because just as I said, in two different theatres in one town, very, very different experiences. So, you know, would expect to see things enforced. How can we encourage visitors to trust each other and agree standards of behaviour? Because it's that worry about how people are behaving. Can we come up with some sort of audience manifesto or something? I don't know how we deal with that. The second reassurance is around access, and I don't just mean disabled access. There could be people travelling in different ways than they were pre-pandemic. they may have previously come on public transport and now are going to drive, so they may have no idea where to park or how to get to you in different routes. Travel by public transport is a key issue for me. We've seen that is the biggest reason people give if they need to travel by public transport to a cultural event. That's the biggest barrier for them. So think about access in its entirety. Toilets, a big one. Toilets are always top of the list on everything, aren't they? Flipping toilets. Right, so yes, but particularly people with disabilities. What's come through very clearly in all of our research, and we've written some papers for We Shall Not Be Removed and all kinds of stuff on this, which are on our website, that disabled audiences and those with particular access needs are much less likely to return. They just don't feel confident about returning, and they're really worried that their needs are being forgotten. I do hope disabled people will be considered in all plans for the reopening and rethinking of cultural venues. That's just really sad that somebody has to say that. The key concerns for them were availability of toilets, priority access if queue management is employed. So, you know, if everybody's going to have to queue, what provisions have you got in place to make sure that disabled people can bypass that queue or come to the front of it? And confidence that disabled seating would still be available even if they were doing social distancing. Now, I'm sure a lot of these things are being considered by cultural organisations, but they're not necessarily being communicated top of the mix. And so, therefore, if they can't see it high in the communications, they're assuming it's not being done and staying away. This is a really nice example. This is Mac in Belfast, who've done a walkthrough video, which is just really, it's fairly low tech and simple. But it's just really nice, so people know exactly what to expect. And they've really played up their access messaging in the video. Third reassurance, financial reassurance. The worry that if somebody books for something and then it's cancelled or they can't attend because they have to self-isolate or they get COVID themselves, that they're just going to lose their money. So, and also, it's not just the money, it's the hassle factor. Oh, I have to go and, you know, change my tickets and all the rest of it. They're more, you know, it's obvious, isn't it? But they're more likely to book if flexible booking plans and refunds and exchanges are in place. So 62% said they'd be more likely to book if they could be given a refund, if they had to cancel or if you cancelled. And 45% said they'd be more likely to book if they could exchange their tickets. This is particularly the case for family audiences. I was speaking at the Family Arts Conference yesterday, and families are the segment most likely to be worried about this and most likely to just not book and leave it till the last minute. And that's the other thing that's going on. We've seen, talking to many of the venues we've been working with, audiences just booking later and later and later. I'm sure some of you will have seen that as well, because they just want to hang on and not risk, and it's largely because of this. This is a really lovely example from Portsmouth Guildhall. They created this little book with confidence guarantee as a result of our work. So they came back to us and said, oh, we already had these refund and exchange policies in place, but they were like shoved away at the bottom of the T's and C's on the fifth page of the website or something. And having heard that this was such a big issue for customers, they brought it right to the top and created a little logo. And they've seen a big difference. So I think with them, if you're unable to attend a performance, you can have a refund or a ticket exchange. Mm-hmm. And I think it's up to 24 hours before, and that's what they were doing before. So they haven't actually changed a thing other than how they're messaging it. The fourth, these are sort of the softer reassurances, but actually these are really important. And this social reassurance one is really, really important for younger people. And as we'll see in a minute, younger people are the key to getting bums on seats going forward. So getting this right is really important. The work that we did with Point One, who are the point of sale software providers, showed how important the kind of social side of it, having a drink before the show, having a drink in the interval, getting an ice cream, getting some popcorn, whatever it is to take into the event. That is as important to many people as what's on the stage. So if, and we had a lot of cultural organisations reopening without those facilities in place at the start, didn't we? So you were going to a classical concert that was an hour long, you had to queue to get in, you sort of went in the back entrance because the foyers weren't open, and you sit there with your mask on going, it's lovely, it's lovely, it's lovely, and then you come out and you can't have a drink. And funnily enough, that's a bit shit. So this is really important. And so people knowing what to expect. And the biggest complaint that venues were getting wasn't that it wasn't happening. It's that they hadn't been told it wasn't happening. So they arrived going, can't have a drink. One of the outdoor attractions where I live in Birmingham, you know, it's an outdoor facility, and their coffee place wasn't open, and people like to walk around the gardens and everything, and the coffee place, they got so many complaints, so they just had to open a little hut and kind of go with the coffees, and it was fine, because it was what people were expecting. So don't ignore that bit of your offer. Can I still have fun with my friends is what they want to know, especially young people. When we looked at this in July with Act Two, being able to visit with a group of people was the most important measure that respondents wanted to see. They'd missed being with people. So to know that they could attend in their bubble and be seated together away from other people was really important to them. Can we have a drink and can we visit the cafe? Do we have to book a table in the bar? Do we have to do that? Do we have to pre-order our drinks? Have we got the right app on our phone? You know, are we going to be sitting there trying to connect to the Wi-Fi, trying to download the app just to get a cup of tea? Really, really important. Are other people having fun and feeling safe? So the power of seeing other people return, a significant proportion of those who haven't yet booked are waiting until venues have been open for a few more months. They want to see that other people are coming back and having a nice time. So we encourage organisations to put images of people enjoying a safe experience, and maybe putting peer reviews on, video clips, Vox Pops, anything they could do. And the lovely Belgrade Theatre Coventry did exactly what we asked them to do and did all of this. So people with masks on, actually enjoying themselves. You know, two older ladies there having a cup of coffee and, you know, and their quotes. And they put these out on social media and we gave them a big thumbs up for that. It's great. And then the final reassurance you need to make sure is happening is brand reassurance. What our audience is saying, we're desperate to get, particularly those with children, desperate to get back to theatre, but this one I think is really important. The constant reminders that a venue is doing everything possible to keep people safe is quite off-putting. We would like to think that you were doing everything to keep people safe. So they're getting a bit fed up of the health and safety messaging, especially the frequent attenders. And they just want to feel like it's going to feel like you. It's not going to be something sanitised within an inch of its life. So will it still feel like the organisation that I love? How will I be made to feel welcome? Will it feel familiar? What came through, and we did some focus groups and online chats with audiences, and what came through very strongly was the point of arrival is the biggest point of anxiety for people. So as they're walking, one lady said to me, as I'm approaching the venue, I will know straight away if I'm going to feel safe by what I can see going on as I approach the venue. So are people queuing? Are they queuing safely? Are people just hoarding around? Are they, you know, what's going on? Are there staff there to clearly explain to people what's going on? One organisation that we talked to, they were concerned that their staff wearing masks would look quite off-putting, so they made them all huge badges saying welcome and ask me questions and can I help, because they look unapproachable with the masks on. And they deliberately put more staff at the entrance because that was where people go, who do I have to show this to? Where do I go? Is there a one-way system? So they had loads of people outside the building directing people in, welcoming them, just being, you know, not full of, you know, checklists and stuff, just being really friendly and welcoming and being available to take questions. And then I really love this example from the National Football Museum in Manchester, who brought their brand into their COVID messaging, which I just think is lovely. A friendly team here to help in the goal there, which I really like. So Now I've bombarded you with that lot, I'm going to bombard you with some more stuff. This is the latest research from our missing audiences survey. So the focus here, because a lot of the conversations we've been having with venues and organisations have been, okay, yeah, but what about the people that haven't been back yet? Why haven't they been back? What's going on? So we did a survey specifically focused on members, audience members who haven't yet returned, and we asked organisations to send this out to people that, according to their database, had not been back yet or hadn't got a future booking in the diary. So to them, looked like they just weren't engaging. And our aim was to try and understand why they weren't coming back. Unfortunately, even half of people who have been back are coming and plan to come less often. So even those people who feel great having come are planning to come less often. Half of the respondents to our survey had not returned to anything. So they'd been sent the survey by Organisation A, and we asked them, have you been to Organisation A? 90% of them hadn't. There's always some that have come with somebody else that aren't, you know, you've missed on the database. 90% of them hadn't, so that was right. But half of them hadn't been anywhere else either. And we included things like National Trust properties and outdoor things. They hadn't been to anything. And a third of the respondents are waiting. I think they're waiting for Godot, because they're waiting for the COVID risk to be lower or for something to change. And it's like, when will they know when that moment is? We're living with COVID now, aren't we, for probably the rest of our lives. So I think there's a significant proportion here of people who are just going to be waiting forever. So my problem is with this, if it means if we're relying on, and again, the narrative has been, oh, well, it'll be fine when it goes back to normal. And when people all come back, there's a whole load of them who aren't coming back, or they're not coming back quickly. And if our business models have relied on a kind of very much on loyal and frequent supporters and attenders, making up the largest proportion of our income and attendances because they come so frequently, A, those who are coming back are going to come less frequently, and B, loads of them aren't coming back. So we've got a real problem with the old business model, which we'll talk about in a minute. This is what my colleagues at Baker Richards, I shan't claim credit for this, did. They're specialists in data-driven segmentation. And they looked at the data we had and categorised them into these five segments, which I think are quite useful, really. Now, you have to bear in mind these proportions are proportions of the people who took the missing audiences survey. So they were already people who we thought weren't very engaged. So I'm not suggesting that these proportions would be across your whole database, but the types will be. You've got about 24% of our sample who are basically behaving as they were pre-COVID. So only a quarter are kind of seeing them as back to normal. And even those people are saying that they will attend less. So they're not really back to normal. They're back to kind of normal, but a bit less. And the reason, if they haven't returned to the surveying organisation, but they've been somewhere else, so they're doing cultural things, they just haven't been back to you, the reason they've not returned that they gave is largely to do with programming. So there just hasn't been something that I've wanted to see. I'm not bothered about COVID. I feel quite happy going back to things. Hasn't been something that I want to see. And these are the people that, talking to venues and organisations who've been doing a lot of work, these are the people that are really now picking and choosing. And rather than maybe go to three things, they're picking one thing and are happy to pay more for it, picking one big ticket item. So I've been saying to people, if you've got a big ticket item, thwack the price up. Because for those things, they will pay more. People are buying Adele tickets, like they went really quickly. What is it, 300 quid or something? Starting price? 800 quid if you want to sit down? I was like, I'm not going to go and stand in Hyde Park for 300 quid and not have a seat.
Yeah.
My husband was like, well, it's 800 quid if you want to sit down. I was like, I'm not going. Yeah. But I'm not typical of that lot. So they will pay more. For something that they're really interested in, but they're not going to take a risk on something that is kind of like a bit hit and miss because, you know, as somebody said to me the other day in a theatre, I have to make a decision if I want to die to see this piece of theatre.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you put it like that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So that's those people. Then you've got the cautious returners who are attending much less frequently than they were before. Safety measures are more important to them. So as we go across here, we sort of move away from programming at one end and COVID at the other end, but programming is still key with those people. The people who've been to things but not back to indoor venues, so they might have been to outdoor performances, they might have been to heritage properties, and their main concern is they're just avoiding crowds of people. They need to manage their own space. And this is particularly important for families, actually. Families, it's really key for them, wherever they are, to be able to be in control of their own space, because they've got to control children within that space. So if you were doing indoor stuff for involving families, I'd be encouraging you to kind of have things where they can have a set of bean bags or a little pitch on the floor or something, rather than fixed seating. Then you've got the non-attenders, which out of this sample are 43%. There's people who've made plans, so they've bought tickets for something in the future, but they haven't been yet. And then there's the third of people who have not returned and have no plans to buy any tickets, a third of this group. Now, it's worth bearing in mind, this segment that we're sending it to are previously very frequent attenders. So they're not people who were kind of a bit hit and miss about the arts anyway. These were people who were previously attending frequently, at least three times to that organisation per year. And a third of these people who haven't been back on their database are not planning to come back. And I'm just going to run you through some. This is a bit graph-tastic, so I will make sure you can have these slides afterwards if they whiz through anything. But you can see that everybody, apart from the back to normal segment, is, and even then it's a little bit, are planning to attend less often than pre-COVID. With the holding out lot, it's massively. With the exception of the holding out, many have already started booking again in different proportions. And this is what I was saying earlier. Removing all restrictions, if you were to go back to doing things as pre-COVID, is going to put everyone off. Even the back to normal segment would be less likely to attend. So throwing away the masks, throwing away the social distancing, throwing away the hand sanitizer, not having anything in place at all, which would probably make Boris Johnson very happy, but he's probably the only person. Even the back to normals aren't happy with that. Vaccine passports, I know they're controversial for lots of reasons, but some sort of vaccine certification are generally welcomed by everybody, including the back to normal people. Most people tend to agree that mask wearing at all times would make them more likely to book. So these holding out people who haven't booked for anything and aren't planning to book for anything, two-thirds of them are saying they would be much more likely to book if all visitors and audiences were wearing masks at all times. If that's all it takes to try and get that group of people who are a third of this cohort over the line, surely it's worth trying. And it will be really interesting to see if the fact that that's mandated in Wales and Scotland makes a difference, because then we'll be able to, we've got our control group, haven't we? So, throwing all of that at you, I'm just going to give you my thoughts on what I think some of that means strategically and long-term for organisations. Now, I'm sure many of you have seen the old Ansoff matrix before, but this is what I always use with organisations I'm working with to look at audience development. So I use it as an audience development matrix. And basically, it says, OK, you've got your programme and your product down this axis, and you're either doing the same thing that you've always done, the same mix of things, or you're going to do new things. And then the audience is up the left-hand side, so you're either aiming something at existing audiences or you're trying to get new audiences. And in the past, the way I've used this, typically with venues who have a mixed programme, but it can work with any organisation, is to plot your programme and your activities onto this matrix. And I did it quite a few years ago with a theatre, and I got the marketing team to do it, and I got the programming team to do it. Well, that was fascinating, because the programming team were like, you know, everything's for... there's a real mixture of what we do across this whole matrix, which is kind of what you want. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer, but actually having a mixture of things, some things to keep existing audiences happy that you've always done, some things to stretch existing audiences into something new, something to attract new audiences in, and it was all spread out. Marketing team, they were like, everything's up here. Everything you're doing is aimed at a new audience and it's a new thing, and we're knackered.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was really interesting. So the way this works, basically, is that my theory about this model is that all of these are audience development. Often when people say audience development, they only mean that one, don't they? Because, oh, that's new, exciting stuff, and we've got to get new people in, and we've got to do new stuff, okay? But actually, loyalty schemes, making sure your existing audiences are coming back and they're coming more frequently, is audience development. And that's basically the bedrock of any good audience development strategy, is making sure you're retaining the people that you've already got and getting them to come more frequently. So that's, in the past, been about increasing loyalty. Then you've got this one with existing audiences for new products. So you're trying to persuade people to try new things, to take more risk. Deepen their engagement with you. It might be as simple as somebody who's only ever been to a performance staying for an after-show talk. Or it could be that you're trying to persuade them to come to something a bit more cutting-edge than they usually do. But that's about deepening engagement. Then you've got this box up here, which is about trying to get new people and new types of people to come to what you already do. Okay, so that's about diversification of the audience or growing audiences. And then this top one is full diversification, where really what this box is about developing new products in order to get different types of people. So that's proper diversification. And of course, the challenge is that the time and the cost goes up diagonally. So the poor organisation that got everything in that top box, they were a bit stuffed, really, because it was a great aspiration, but it was very hard for them to deliver short term. And they weren't meeting their sales targets. So that's how it used to work. But I'd like to talk to you about how I think it needs to work or might work post-COVID. So the bottom left box, of course, used to be the foundation of any good audience development strategy and probably any business model in the arts, getting people who've engaged with you previously to come back to similar stuff more often. Build frequency and loyalty, probably the heart of your membership scheme and where most of your donations would come from. But of course, that's the foundation that is now in peril, I think, with the data that I've shown you. The very attenders that were propping up our income and our frequency levels are the demographic least likely to come back. And those who are doing are going to do so less frequently. So whilst we can do all my five reassurances, and I think we should, I don't think these people are going to return at anywhere near the levels that they were pre-pandemic, and for that to be a sustainable business model going forwards. So I don't know how much of your activity, it'd be interesting for you to plot the time and effort that your programme and then the time and effort that your team are putting into these four boxes pre-COVID. But, you know, my estimate is that a lot of organisations would be spending 75% of their time and effort and programme on existing audiences. And if that's what you were doing, you can't carry on doing that, would be my suggestion. So we've got to maintain and reassure as much as we can. We've got to do everything we can to get those audiences back and to keep them confident about what we're doing, but with the knowledge that they're not going to come back at the same frequency. Then you've got this box to the right of that. So this was previously where you were trying to use your existing audience to move them onto new things. Well, if they're not coming back in the same numbers, you've got a problem. And I think that's where we're looking at things like adaptation of formats in order to get them back in some capacity. So things like outdoor work, you know, many of you have already pivoted into outdoor and digital in order to do this. And I think that's where that fits. So it's about saying, okay, so existing audiences, a lot of them don't feel comfortable coming back indoors in quite that way, but how could we change the format of that so that it would be more acceptable to them? So that's where I think that fits. And that's where things like the Garden Theatre at the RSC, with huge amounts of money, I realise, And Home Ground in Manchester, which wasn't done with huge amounts of money, have done really well. And I was talking to John, who runs Home in Manchester, the other day, and he was telling me that they've done some audience analysis now on this, and this has actually attracted a brand new audience and a much more diverse audience for them. And the conversation that I've had, not with them, but with many other organisations about where they've done something like this, and then they've gone, great, so all those people are now going to come into Home or come into the venue. And you're like, is that why you're doing it? Is that why we're doing this work? Because it's basically a feeder back into the venue. Or does that work stand on its own? And I guess this plays into some of what Alan will have been talking about yesterday. You know, is that work valid in its own right? Or is that always just a kind of feeder for the venue? And of course, most of the people I'm talking to are venues, and so that's the way they think. But I think we've got to start changing that. And then the Young Vic, who've promised to put every single play that they're doing online this year. Now, I know these are all big organisations with lots of money, but you can see, and so they've been able to sort of innovate first in this space. So then we get into this top left-hand box, which is the one I have the most problem with, really, because I've worked in this industry for a long time, and in audience development and marketing for a long time, and all we've talked about for 25 years is diversifying our audiences. And yet, we've basically been trying to get different people to come to the same old stuff. And funnily enough, audiences haven't really changed in 25 years in terms of their, as a sector. The makeup of the audience, I've been tracking it, hasn't really changed very much. And, you know, rightly now, the Arts Council and various other people are kind of going, right, that has to change now. But getting people to come to the same old stuff hasn't really worked for us in the past. So if that's what we've got to do now, why is it going to work now? Just because of COVID? And if we know there's an underlying hesitancy about coming to cultural venues from even the people that were really engaged before, why suddenly are people that weren't interested now going to be interested? So we've seen some kind of glimmers of hope with certain bits of programming, things like Six the Musical, which is aimed at a much younger audience, has done really well because those people are less worried about coming to things with COVID. And so maybe some programming shifts would get us part of the way there, but they're quite risky. And is there enough product out there that kind of fits that mold? Six is kind of out there as an outlier and everybody's booking it. But what else is there like that that's a tried and tested seat filler and gets a different audience? Not many. So then that leaves us this box, which previously I was encouraging people to use with caution and to make sure that they were planning it properly. And now I'm kind of like, I think we really might have to throw the kitchen sink at this top right-hand box now. Because we can't rely on the others all the way through. So I think it's, if you haven't started having this conversation in your organisation about what you're doing in that top right-hand box, now is the time to start that because it takes so much time. And I think what it is about is completely re-looking at our offer as arts organisations in order to attract different audiences. We need to get different audiences in. Morally, we need to get different audiences in, but now commercially. It's a commercial imperative now, not just a moral one. So we've got to do it. And I think lots of people much more qualified to speak about this stuff than I am. But, you know, if you haven't read Nina Simon's book, The Art of Relevance, it probably needs to be top of your list now. And I think it all basically does come back to relevance. You know, we need to have more conversations about what the people in our communities need. And again, I'm sure this is what Alan was saying yesterday, and how we can use the assets and the people and the skills and the artists that we have access to meet those needs, rather than, in my experience over the years I've been working in this industry, it's like, well, here's the art we want to do. You marketing people, go and find the people that are going to come to it. Oh, and they're not diverse enough, so go and sort that out as well. But we need to have some fundamental conversations in that. And I think we need to think differently about our buildings, where we have buildings, our people, our assets, and be really ready to challenge the norm in every sense. I think it will mean doing things in different spaces, and I think the quickest route to it will be through partnership. you know, the lesson I've learned through this pandemic is reach out to people that you're previously competing with and there'll be some benefits. And I think there's a lesson in there for all of us. So things like, why isn't that working? Hang on. Things like the CBSO Symphonic Sessions that they've just launched in Birmingham is in conjunction with Hockley Social Club, which is like an outdoor dining space with sort of food stalls around the outside, and they have DJs and stuff. And somebody who works for the CBSO knows somebody who works there, and they went, should we just try this? And they've tried it, huge success. They've only done one, and they're now planning to, they've got a sponsor, and they're planning to do loads more. And it definitely, I did the research on it, definitely attracts a different audience. Now, it's a tiny step. It's not going to replace all the seats they can't sell at Symphony Hall, but it's a step, and it's in partnership. And then the final thing I just want to show you is this. I really like this model because it's the funnel of innovation. I've always sort of thought that innovation is something, you know, these amazing people, bonkers, most of them, Elon Musk and all the rest of them, they're all crazy, that they just, that their brains work in a different way and they wake up one morning with some fantastic idea and then they go and do it. It doesn't work like that. What this shows, and this is from manufacturing and industry, is that in order to end up with one idea that's implementable, you have to generate 50, might be more. You have to harvest them and test them and develop them, and you might only end up with one. How many meetings have you sat in where you've generated 50 ideas and thrown 49 of them away? I don't remember the last time I was in a meeting or a process like that, and I'm not sure as an industry that we're very good at doing that. So everything has to, and it, partly the funding model doesn't help, you know, everything has to not fail. And how do we do that? How do we persuade our funders that we need R&D money and we need to be allowed to fail and we need to have these conversations? So I am going to finish there. Please go onto the website, download the reports if you want them. There's tons and tons on there. If you haven't been involved with us so far and you would like to be, we're doing wave two of missing audiences in January and February. And if you have a database of attenders and can some, I mean, you don't have to sift out the ones who haven't been. So if you just have a mailing list, you could just send it to them and the survey will deal with that. But if you can sift out the ones that according to your data haven't been, then send it to those. So please, it's all, everything we've done is free to be involved in. So spread the word, get as many festivals involved as possible because they're still a tiny proportion of our data and we'd love to have more. And that's me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Katie. That was brilliant. I think lots and lots of food for thought there. You know, really amazing insight into audiences now and the audiences of the future. Particularly, I really thought it was really thought provoking what you were saying about these missing audiences. So I had a question just to start us off, which was when, because obviously I'm based in Scotland and I saw that EIF and The Fringe were there as being participants in the survey. And I just wondered what the research has showed, because obviously in Scotland, you know, we are wearing masks, we are still doing some social distances in our cultural venues. EIF was a really good example of that in terms of the model they adopted. So did it show that audiences in Scotland are actually more ready to go back to cultural venues because all these outliers as to why people aren't going are in place? I wondered if there was any insights into that.
There's a tiny bit of difference between with the missing audiences when we said what would make you less likely to attend, Scottish and Welsh and Northern Ireland audiences, so all the nations and regions where mask wearing is mandatory, said they were less likely to go back without masks. Mm-hmm. Partly because they'd be breaking the law, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be much more of an expectation. Oh, God, why would you go to that if people weren't all wearing masks? Mm-hmm. So we have seen a tiny bit of difference in that, but not really in much else at the moment.
Okay. And then I really loved that funnel of innovation at the end. I thought that was a really great model. And I just wondered, I mean, you obviously did highlight some case studies, but I wondered in the research if anything had really jumped out in terms of where, you know, venues or festivals are really doing things differently, particularly in terms of those new audiences?
And I think it's difficult because most of the organisations I've spoken to over the last 18 months have been really struggling with that pivot thing, as we all have. And I think they sort of fall into three categories, really. There's the ones who kind of just stopped doing everything. Then there's the ones who went, okay, so let's pivot to outdoor or digital until we can just go back, with every intention of just swinging straight back. And I've seen them now swing straight back. So I'm working on an AHRC project with Kent University at the moment, looking at digital audiences. And we found that of all the theatres that were producing digital content during the pandemic, over half of them now aren't producing anything. So they've just they've fallen into that second category. And then there's the third category, who are the ones who've recognised that the world will never be the same again, and there is no going back, and we have to start thinking about, you know, sort of managed decline, for want of a better word, of the old audience, and putting the, and companies like Rombert. I was talking to Joe Taylor, who works for Rombert, the marketing director there, and that's how they're thinking about it. So they're kind of going, right, we have to forge ahead now and think completely differently. Our old audience is dead, and we need to, you know. And the problem that I see is that many organisations are paralysed by that older audience because they're their donors, they're their members, they're the loudest, they have the deepest, previously had the deepest pockets. They've been used to having that level of influence over the organisation. And now you're kind of going, sorry, guys, but the game's changed. So companies like Rombert, definitely. There've been some, you know, even little tiny organisations that have sort of experimented in the digital space, Little Angel Theatre and organisations like that, where they've just sort of been trying things out and learning. And I think they're more likely to land on the one big thing at the end of the funnel because they've been practising things. And what I've been saying to people all the way through this is, at the moment, audiences are quite forgiving. And you can do things in beta and go, we're just trying this, and then you can abandon it. And people will, if you explain to them that's what you're doing, I think they'll go with it. I think that window is closing. And if you waste that opportunity, then I think it'd be like, well, haven't you figured it out yet?
Okay, I'm really keen to hear from the room, particularly if anyone's got any insights or comments around this adaptation of formats, using new ideas, any research they've done on their own audiences. Yes? If you maybe say who you are before you speak as well.
Gosh, there's a lot in that question. I think, yes, I think the funding bodies are starting to look at that. I mean, I know Arts Council England, with their Let's Create strategy, we're already thinking in that way, and some of the messaging that's come out of them. I don't know about Creative Scotland, and Arts Council Northern Ireland, I know, we're also having similar conversations, as are Wales. So I do think, but I think we need to be telling them as well, that, you know, to give them confidence to say, you know, we're up for this, but we need you to lead, and we need you to commit to helping us to do this, and we need a change of culture in the whole sector about experimentation and R&D. I think they're much more likely to support things that are done in partnership. So I think consortia of organisations saying we're all going to try and tackle this together would be a much more attractive funding option for them than one going, I've got this mad idea like Elon Musk, and I can only afford to test one. Whereas between you, if you could test 50 and then land on the one, you might have a better chance. And the other thing I think will be an opportunity for funding is place-based stuff. I think place-based culture is a massively growing need. Understanding the place in which you operate, the whole levelling up agenda in England anyway, lots of money. I've just done some work for Kidderminster Town Hall, where they've just got millions out of the government through the levelling up fund to redevelop the town hall, not to be a performing arts venue, but to be a venue for the whole community and, you know, do a whole wide range of things in that box that we, you know, that we talked about. So I think you'll have more chance if you concentrate on place-based and concentrate on partnerships, would be my thinking.
I think that ties in very clearly with what Alan was saying yesterday, that they've gone from being an outdoor arts organisation to being a whole community centre and catalyst. Yes, Stuart?
They are, but also I think you have to look at it through the what do we need to produce in order to get those audiences, rather than what are we doing and how do we reach the audiences. It's just a completely different way of looking at it. And things like, I don't know how many of you saw the Little Amal, the walk, that thing, as part of Coventry City of Culture, but you know, that came to a part of Birmingham where I don't live in Erdington, but in a part of Birmingham where I do live, and I've just done a piece of work for the Commonwealth Games looking at the engagement levels across the whole of the West Midlands, and Erdington is one of the areas that's the least engaged with culture, and the Little Amal thing came there, and there were children who'd made their own puppets and models running to meet her in the street, and it just made me cry, because this is an area that every arts organisation, the CBSO, the REP, the Hippodrome, BRB in Birmingham, have all tried to get to people in Erdington and failed. Yeah, and this thing comes in because it's relevant to them. There's a big Syrian refugee community in Erdington, and this was all about refugees. And it's about finding the thing that connects those people. Now, that was huge budget, I realise that. But we've got to start at the right end of the telescope. And easy for me to say that. I know I'm just a consultant and I'm not an artist, but we need to allow artists to respond to that challenge and to find out how we're going to do that. And I do think it's bigger than all of us, and we have to find ways of doing it together. Because with the limited budgets you have, none of you can crack this on your own. But if we all agree that's what we're trying to do, then maybe we can get somewhere and lobby the funders to help us do it.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, Sonia? Mm.
It's the idea of failing fast, isn't there? I said that to somebody the other day, and they looked at me like, why would you want to fail fast? I was like, you certainly don't want to fail slow.
Yeah, I think it links into that whole idea of incremental gain as well, isn't it? It's like small, small things. I think we'll probably have to stop there because I know we've gone over time. And I just wanted to end on one thing that you said that really, really resonated with me. And I think it's one thing we have to take away with us is that 82% of audiences said that the act of attending makes them feel brilliant. So I think that's the one thing we have to take away from all this, that the audiences are out there, they do want to attend, and it's our job as festivals to make that as painless as possible. And obviously we've got such brilliant data and insights from organisations like Indigo, which really make that a lot easier, I think. So thank you so much, Katie, for all the work that you're doing for the sector. I think it's amazing. And yeah, please do get involved, everybody in the room that are there working on festivals. You know, this data is brilliant. So thank you very much.
Thank you.